I'm going to open the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Good morning, all.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 112.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, Senate Bill 112 allows certain retired members of the public employees' retirement system who elected to receive a lump sum payment of benefits to be reemployed by a public employer subject to limitations on the number of hours of employment without repayment of the lump sum that's been received. The original measure came out on a 3-1 vote from the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee and off the Senate floor with a 19-10 vote. You have in front of you, members, a -6 amendment which replaces the verbiage of the measure. It maintains the original measure's provisions, but also clarifies that hours that are worked by a person employed in positions are exempted from the PERS 1,040-hour limit cannot be counted for the purpose of limitations on employment that's imposed by statute, and also adds an emergency clause effective upon passage.
Mr. Cleary, why don't you come on up here? And I'd be interested to know what the 10 people that voted no on, if you have any idea on why they voted no.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. I'm Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. I'll start with the bill itself as it was originally filed. This is the one bill that the agency filed with the approval of the PERS board. And it was designed to address an inconsistency that we've got in our current statutes. Right now, if you retire and receive a monthly benefit, you can work half-time, the 1039 hours that everyone is accustomed to. But if you retire and take a lump sum and aren't getting a monthly benefit, you don't fall under that. You fall under the older provision, which was 600 hours. We have had a number of folks that have retired. Everyone knows the 1039 rule. They get caught in this trap, so we're just trying to levelize the playing field, if you will. And so anyone who retires out of the PERS system can work half-time. It's not going to increase the number of people who are working, doesn't give any additional exemption, and so forth. That's the bill as introduced, and I'm also prepared to speak to the -6 amendments as well when those, if you'd like me to cover those now. Or,
yes, please, go ahead.
And we've got another informational memo on that. I'll have Susan pass that around. This is an amendment that we worked with Representative Cameron on. This also addresses an inconsistency and a misinterpretation in our statutes. Right now, members can work for what we call exempt employers unlimited hours, and these were designed to address workforce shortage issues. An example is people who work in police forces in very small communities, I think 15,000 or less, and they can work unlimited hours with that. But when you read a combination of the two statutes, if they're also working for another employer, the hours add up and they fall under the 1039 limit. And we've had people, again, that didn't intend to violate that limit, weren't aware that concurrent employment could do that, and all of a sudden we're having to unretire people, capture benefits back from them, again, it's a complication that we don't need in the system, so it falls under what we would consider a technical amendment to the bill. In terms of what happened on the Senate side, I think in looking at the transcript of the remarks on the floor, it didn't have anything to do with the technical nature of these adjustments. It was more around just the whole issue of retire and rehire. And I'd like to point out that this doesn't expand any of those provisions. There's no new additions here to who falls under the 1039 exceptions or not. And I think there was some confusion over there. So it was more around that issue. And that is an issue that we have committed to working with the stakeholders and with the legislature in the interim on, because we've got to get a handle around this whole issue of people coming back and working after retirement. We right now have got about a page of exemptions to this 1039 restriction, and it gets really complicated for us, it gets complicated for the members, and we end up with people falling into these unintended consequences and us having to take some pretty draconian measures. One of the things that we're trying to address with the original bill, we've had to try to bill someone for $400,000 when they took a lump sum payment, and 3 years later we found out that they kept working that first 6 months and exceeded the 600-hour limit. And then another, we have to unretire people and then immediately re-retire them again, so it creates a lot of work. So those are these technical amendments, but this issue of working after retirement is an issue that, as you know, Chair Schaufler, has got even the labor groups are kind of split on it. The employers are kind of split on it. We're going to work over the interim to try to find some common ground around that question.
Well, you know, I mean, it's no secret. If I worked my whole life for 30 years, I invested in the stock market, I put that away, rolled over in some land, and that land was giving me rent every month, I could still go work for anybody I wanted to.
That's right.
And I'd still be getting that money. You know, I see a PERS pension as exactly the same thing. It's mine. I own it. Has nothing to do with if someone wants to hire me. Great, I still get that because it's mine. That's my opinion. I know not everyone shares
right,
that opinion.
Right.
But it is mine. I invested in it. I own it. It's mine, free and clear. That's my opinion. I believe I saw, did anyone have their hand up over there? Representative Esquivel and Representative Cameron.
Thank you.
Probably shock you here, Mr. Chair, but I agree with that. I would like to even see something go so far as, I don't know why we're penalizing people when they come back to work for the state or county or municipality just because they've been on PERS. If they went to work for Boeing, if they went to work for Nike, there wouldn't be any consequences. So what's the difference? I look at it like, okay, fine, if people want to come back to work, if they've received a lump sum or if they've received payments or whatever, that's fine. If they want to come back to work in the state, that's fine, or the county, that's fine, but they wouldn't be on the PERS system at that point.
Right.
That would be the way to alleviate the whole problem, and then you couldn't accuse people of what they call, which I get a chuckle out of, double dipping. I don't understand that. But
it ain't double dipping. That's
anyway, that would be the way to take care of the whole problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Paul, thank you for working with our office and getting these amendments. And just on the record to clarify here, so everybody understands this, an individual can work up to the 1039 hours in a what I want to call a non-exempt place, stop, and then go over and work an exempt position for another 1,000 hours, and they're okay. It was the timing of when that those 2,000 hours took place, because they were happening together. This guy ended up getting in trouble, and so did the small city. This is actually a city where he volunteers as a police officer, or doesn't volunteer, but he works as a police officer in one of the small towns I represent, under 15,000. So that's to clarify on the amendments, and I thank you for working with us on that. The question I do have, though, is on this lump sum payment, because I got an education from you over this experience. When he violated the whatever, when he went over the 1039 rule, that we're going to try to clarify, once you found that out, you unretired him and stopped his benefit payments.
Right.
On a lump sum issue, we're changing it from 600 to 1039. I got that. Right. How do you, somebody violates the 1039 rule, now how do you, what leverage do you have if the lump sum's been paid out to unretire that person?
Chair Schaufler, Representative Cameron, excellent question. We've got a little bit different leverage with somebody on a monthly benefit, because obviously we can collect the overpayment over time from them. People with lump sums, it's either a negotiated settlement, or we've had one individual who basically said, I don't want to pay you back, I don't want to quit working. Because of our statute, that constitutes a potential plan disqualification issue with the IRS, so we had to go to the extent of terminating this individual as a member, which means that they would no longer have any membership rights, including the ability to enter into PERS health insurance. So it's pretty draconian. The statute requires us, once somebody violates these hour limits, to basically collect back whatever retirement payment they've collected from us. Obviously, somebody on a monthly hasn't collected anywhere. You know, if we interrupt it in the first 2 years of their retirement, it's not like they've collected 40 years, but a lump sum person has taken everything out initially. So again, that's what we're trying to avoid. We're just trying to level the playing field here and make sure that people have a clear understanding of what these restrictions are. It makes it more simpler. It does not deal with this broader question of double dipping or anything else, and that's got employment issues, it's got public perception issues. It's got political issues, and those are the kind of things that we've got to deal with in over the interim. But you're right, Representative Cameron. One of the things we're trying to do is avoid having to go into collection efforts against people, particularly in some of these cases, that don't have the money anymore. If they've taken it out in a lump sum and rolled it over into some other investment, unless you put it into 90-day T-bills or the mattress in 2008, you lost some.
This is a follow-up. So clarification, in this situation where you helped
right.
us with in our district, had that individual taken the lump sum, you would have sent them a notice basically that said, you need to pay this back?
The entire amount, right.
And if the money was gone?
We'd be in this kind of situation like we were with this other individual.
Okay. So following up on what Representative Escobar said, if we change
right.
the position where anybody comes back, they're no longer in PERS, they're just an employee without PERS benefits. Or
I'd like to correct, they aren't in PERS when they come back. They haven't violated the provisions of the retirement. So until they exceed 1039 hours, unless they're in exempt employment, or if they're double lump sum once this bill passes, they're okay. They only come back to PERS if they've exceeded these violations. We don't they don't get any additional benefits under it. And there, I think, maybe is your point to the double dipping question.
Let them have it. Period.
Yeah, you can go to work for a non-PERS employer, whether it be in the private sector in Oregon, or some public employers aren't PERS employers, or across the river in Washington, and vice versa. But again, broader issues, not part of these bills. These bills are more to address these technical questions.
That's exactly what I'd recommend a retired worker to do, just to avoid all this hassle. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can appreciate the focus and the scope of this bill, but you know, one of the problems that I see, particularly in public safety, is with PERS, we lose a lot of great talent out there to retirement, and in some cases they're at an age where they're not wanting to work the road anymore. Some of these folks are administrative people, right. And then they're kind of exempt from working in the state of Oregon, but then we'll allow somebody else retired from another state to come and work those full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Think about the small jurisdiction that don't really have any, they haven't done succession planning. They're doing a national scope out there to find somebody. Meanwhile, they're struggling to fill a void in their administrative personnel that could be filled by one of these retired folks throughout the area. And it's not happening. So I can appreciate what the amendment does and what we're looking at in this bill. But I think the big thing with the system that people don't necessarily understand is that insurance is probably, I think, on the average $1,100 to $1,200 is what they're paying in addition. You know, an example of this, someone that had their retirement numbers and thought they were going to be great is now working the night shift driving a forklift in a warehouse after he was our deputy chief for a number of years.
Right.
So it's just kind of unfortunate, and only doing that to pay for health insurance. So it's not a perfect system. I appreciate your work and what you do. I do think there's a perception problem with the system and how we battle that. Hard to educate people who don't want to be educated. I think teachers struggle with that with students, and sometimes we do with community. But I appreciate your bill bringing it forward. But there are some flaws in the system, and they really do cripple a lot of our communities in terms of how we address problems short-term versus long-term.
You know, I think what the perception problem is flat-out jealousy. This person worked 30 years of their life, invested well, consciously made a conscious decision probably to work for less than they could have met in the private sector, and they ended up with a good benefit, and now the other people that ain't got that are jealous. That's really what I think it is. I better shut my mouth before I get myself in more trouble.
YouTube is filling up fast.
Unbelievable, man. anyway, any further questions of Mr. Cleary? We do not have the paperwork, we do have...
Do you want me to point that out, Mr. Chair?
Yes, would you please, Teresa?
So, committee members, we do have the revenue analysis on the -6. We do not have the fiscal analysis. However, in the memo that was just distributed, the agency has indicated there is, the amendment does not create a fiscal impact.
Right.
So we can't suspend the rules, if you wish, and move the bill out.
Okay. Anyone, are you finished,
no,
Mr. Cleary?
No.
All right. Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 112 today or the -6 amendment? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing. I'm going to open work session on Senate Bill 112. Oh, nope, I'm not. I'm going to open a work session. I'm going to entertain a motion to suspend the rules. If somebody would like to.
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for Senate Bill 112 for the purpose of voting on Senate Bill 112 without the fiscal impact statement being available. We have a statement from the agencies that says that there is no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of voting on Senate Bill 112 without having the benefit of a fiscal impact statement. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Now I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 112.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 112.
Representative Cameron moves the Senate of the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 112. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Representative?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 112 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 112 floor due pass as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. I think we should have a conversation. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor? Representative, you're always there for me. Thank you. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 112. We're just going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 142.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 142 prohibits the practice of photogrammetric mapping without registering with the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, otherwise known as OSBILS. The measure authorizes the board to issue a registration without examination to an individual who holds a substantially equivalent certification from another state or country, and also requires the photogrammetrist to sign and stamp final documents, including a seal authorized by the board. The measure passed unanimously out of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and off the Senate floor with a 21-7 vote.
Thank you. Dan Lindscheid or Scheld? I hope I'm right, saying your name right, Dan. And if you have someone who would like to come with you. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Schaffer.
Welcome.
I have with me today the President of the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveyor, Sue Laszlo, and the Executive Secretary, Maury Lopez. Senate Bill 142. Basically a housekeeping bill. The thrust that the board wanted on this was in Section 3, bottom of page 2. When we went through Senate Bill 55 two sessions ago, there was a lot of change in that bill, and we neglected. When we came up with Oregon administrative rules and everything, we came up with this nice stamp for photogrammetries that have this aircraft on it with a camera looking down and all this really cool stuff, but we didn't have in the original bill a requirement that those new licensees as photogrammetrists sign and seal their documents saying that they were in charge. And so that's what this really did. 90% of this was housekeeping, removing the word shall, etc. So it's a I don't think there's much opposition.
What is a photogrammetrist? We're barely going to have to back way up here for everybody, especially me.
Well, everybody looks like deer in the headlights up there.
Chair, committee members, photogrammetry is the art and science of these are the people that apply with these high-tech cameras really high, and they take really high-resolution photography, and it's photo-rectified to bring it in so that it's orthometric instead of being so you don't get all these tilts and all this really distortion out on the fringes. It brings it in so that
you are way orthometric.
What's orthometric?
Je parle un peu de français aussi, monsieur. You're way over my head.
Mr. Chair, is this similar to what Google Earth and Zillow and all those are using now, or is this different?
Chair Schaffer, Representative Matthews, that is photo rectified, and they do that with a pass quilt. And I'm not a photogrammetrist myself, I'm a land surveyor. But to be a photogrammetrist, they have to go through some of the requirements to get there through the land surveying regimen. So they have to know what this is going to look like, their final product. They have to know their stuff pretty much. And I don't, I get very, when I get in the presence of these photogrammetrists too. So this is a new title for us, but we're dealing with it. We haven't had any problems so far.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also not a photogrammetrist.
A photographer.
But he can be rather obtuse at times.
But why is it good public policy that your board, that such people have to register with your board? Why is this important?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Barton, since 1919, engineers have been required to be registered in the state of Oregon. That followed a national trend. Land surveyors came along in 1940, I believe, somewhere in there. And it's always been that they have to sign and seal their documents so that the public, when they see these maps and drawings and et cetera, they'll know who the responsible party was. And so that's what this is really all about. And we just failed to put it in two sessions ago, even though we had a guidance from the AAG.
And we use these photos for mapping and planning, designing, engineering, roads, all kinds of stuff.
That's right. That's what's going to differentiate.
You have to identify yourself.
This is Sue Laszlo.
Yes.
I'm the chair of OSBILS currently, Representative Schaffler and Vice Chair Barton. The photogrammetrists, what we are doing here is these folks who are registered, it's going to be different than what you see in Google Earth. When you take information from Google Earth, you're not necessarily certain exactly what the level of accuracy that you have for your documents. The photogrammetrist actually gets these documents to a level in which a surveyor or an engineer can use them for planning for some different levels of design. And so that's really the reason for us to want to register these folks, to protect the public, so that as we're using their documents, we have a level of certainty that they're accurate and that we can rely on them.
Does a photogrammetrist, is that person an engineer necessarily, or what's their level of training and education?
Chair Schaffler, they are not an engineer. They're not land surveyors. They cannot do boundary work on the ground. They are required to go through, unless they're grandfathered under Senate Bill 55, they're required now to go through rigorous training and get the experience required to sit for the land surveyor intern exam, the national exam. So that's as far as it goes with the land surveying. They have to know their land surveying to a certain extent, but they're not going to be able to stamp surveys.
And I know my questions aren't necessarily related to the substance of your change here, but I'm just curious. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I looked up photogrammetrist on Merriam-Webster online, and it does say the science of making reliable measurements by the use of photographs, and especially aerial photographs. So I take this as precision work. It's not just snapping photos out of a plane. It's measurement and stuff like that. So.
And that is correct. Any further questions? Miss, do you have something?
No.
Okay. Any further questions?
I have one question.
Representative.
When we have this, does it have the example, does it have meets and bounds with it, or does it have some sort of a, okay, you're looking at a piece of property that's 2 3/4 mile by such and such and such and such. I mean, what's the accuracy point here?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Escobar, what we're dealing with is they're taking, in this day and age, digital photography, and it's depending on what their height in the camera and all these things, it comes down with different resolutions. Google Earth, in some places, if you go look at that, it has really rough, crude-looking photography. But when a photogrammetrist does it, it comes back and they'll tell you exactly what all the parameters were, the camera height and the speed and all these things, and it does not show meets and bounds or landlines unless those have been laid on separately after the fact. Usually they'll use ground control they'll know exactly how far it is between this point and this point and this point and this point, for example, and they'll use those to rectify the imagery so that it stretched out just exactly 90 degrees. So you're right, looking right down, no matter where you are over that drawing or that photograph, you're at 90 degrees to it. Is that clear?
Yeah, I understand that, but I mean, I'm just...
No meets and bounds.
Struggling.
Chair Schaffler and Representative Esquivel, if you're wondering what the application might be for something like this, what we could use it for is you can actually, if you're working with a land surveyor, you would be able to put topography into a large area. So you would be able to have your manholes identified. If you spray paint your manholes, if you do certain things from the air, you can then identify these different utility markers and then identify what the topography is so that you can do your planning and layouts. That would be an application, and that's why we want to have someone certified.
And the level of accuracy is just incredible these days, I understand, too. So it's amazing. Representative Thatcher.
I find this pretty fascinating, actually.
It is.
I was thinking, okay, so what level of accuracy do we need to get? They're taking pictures. Okay, but then he cleared it up with his little Merriam-Webster dictionary definition there. But I'm wondering, what do other states do? Do all other states register or do something similar to what we're trying to do here or have done?
Representative Thatcher, we're one of the first states in the nation to do this. It's under the National Council of Engineering Examiners for Surveyors, Engineers and Surveyors, NC2ES. It's under their model rules, model laws. We're one of the first ones to take on this and redefine the practice of surveying 2 years ago or 4 years ago, as well as we licensed our photogrammetrists. Not all states are doing that. We just thought that it was going to be better to protect the public to see that licensure level established. And at that time, the session, legislative session, agreed with us.
And I guess I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Before registering and doing regulating, essentially, were there problems with inaccurate or rogue photogrammetrists out there?
I don't think so. There are probably only at most 24 photogrammetrists in the entire state of Oregon. So this has not really been a big, big issue. But they wanted to be licensed, and with the working with OSBILS, we saw that there could be. But as we, you know, this thing has blossomed with all the digital photography nowadays, and we saw that there may be more of a need for licensure. The questions go more to licensure than they do to the housekeeping nature of this bill. But be that as it may, I think this is a valid thing that we have licensure for these folks. Most of them are engineers. Almost all of them are engineers. So there were hardly any, maybe one or two, who were not already engineers. So they know their stuff.
Any further questions of these good people? Ms. Laszlo, I this is the only setting I ever see you in, and I hope that you don't find this indelicate question. Is your father still with us?
He is. Thank you for asking. No. He's doing very well, and I shared with him your story. In fact, I made sure that I could tape it so he could hear it. Because he's out in the Clackamas River area where he has only dial-up, so he couldn't actually listen to the session that we had when he told your story. But he was delighted. He was actually delighted that you remembered, and he remembered that story very clearly as well.
Oh, man, I tell you, we had to chip this styrofoam out of these wall panels, and I was just pulling my hair out, and he came out and said, "Well, Mike, the easiest thing in the world to do is complain. We need to find a solution." I'll just never forget how calming a presence he was and what a delightful man he was to work with. So make sure and say hello.
I will definitely.
For me and the rest of the crew that was there, I'm sure. So, any further questions to these very good people? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is one of those bills that makes me enjoy being a legislator because it's like going to college every day and we learn. This is straightforward. Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 142 today? Seeing no one, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 142 and open work session on Senate Bill 142. And I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 142 to the floor with a deep pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves move Senate Bill 142 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative.
Just one comment. I guess I look at registrations and certifications as a way of limiting, and I have some issue with that. I understand what they're getting at, but I don't think there was a problem. And I know I understand that this is just merely housekeeping on something that already exists. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where I'm at yet, but we'll see what word comes out of my mouth when you call the roll.
My only response to that is when you're building America, it's fairly important you're accurate because a lot of bad things can happen if you're not. Any other discussion on the motion? Is there opposition to the motion? Seeing, is there opposition? Any opposition?
No, I'm just
seeing
saying
no opposition. So moved.
Mr. Chair, I just think whoever carries this should be the one amongst us who can actually say photogrammetrist repeatedly.
You did a pretty good job right there.
I don't know if I can do
Are
it.
Are you volunteering?
Absolutely not, Mr. Chair. Representative Edwards, however, with Marion Webster.
Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this fine bill?
I'll carry this bill.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative. Representative Matthews. I'm going to close the words on Senate Bill 142. And then I'm going to...
It's at the firehouse.
We'll all be there to help you, Representative. Got to hold it down around here.
You want me to get you a visual?
I'm going to... I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 143.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 143 removes the exemption for registering with OSBILS for engineering done on residences and small commercial buildings when performed by a registered professional engineer. The measure passed unanimously out of the Business and Transportation Committee and off the Senate floor with a 22-6 vote.
And I assume we have Mr. Davis here with his excellent team here to back him up.
Outstanding team. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Grant Davis. I'm a consulting engineer in private practice and chairman-elect of OSBILS, Oregon Board of Examiners for Engineers and Land Surveyors, and here to testify about Senate Bill 143. And I apologize. I sent an email, but I misunderstood. I thought this was just going to be a hearing with the subcommittee, so I sent it just to the subcommittee members. So it's out there.
Yeah, we'll get
it. And I have a copy that I can leave with you. So you want me to go ahead and
Tell us what we're doing here.
The reason for this is that the current statute, ORS 672.060, exempts persons, and that I think that's a key word, persons, from basically following the rules for architects and engineers on houses and small commercial buildings. And that was written initially, and it's very reasonable. It allows house designers and contractors that are competent to do the kind of work that they know how to do well. I mean, there's prescriptive sections within the code that basically tells you how to build a house. You don't really need an architect or an engineer to do that. The unintended consequence was that when the statute was written, the word persons was also later found to be interpreted to include engineers too. So basically we've exempted engineers from the engineers' laws when they do houses and small commercial buildings. And what we're trying to do is exempt the engineers from the exemption now and reverse that. And the reason is that we've had several cases in the last few years where engineers who are registered in other disciplines like nuclear, mechanical, or whatever are holding themselves out as engineers. And as you might expect, in the last few years, there have been some very expensive homes, very complex homes that need engineering. So the owners go out and hire an engineer, a registered engineer, to do it. The engineers do it. They really aren't competent to do it. We then get at the board, which is what we do, is sort of regulate the profession, complaints about these engineers that they're incompetent to do the work they've been doing. We then try to go after them, and we can't go after them because they've been exempted from basically the statutes and laws that control the profession because they're people. And the statute, as it's written right now, has exempted them from the laws of the profession. So we're here to try to remedy that and get them back to doing, whenever they do a house or a small commercial building, they still have to act as engineers. They still have to stamp, and that's the key, stamp and certify that what they have done is good engineering practice. And then if they don't, we then have the tools to go after them at the state board. So it's pretty much as simple as that.
Yeah, I've read several stories in the paper about foundation snapping off, and
we've had some real bad actors in the state. They're engineers, they can do whatever they want to do, and they've been doing it, and we're powerless to do anything about it, which has been very frustrating.
Core samples of soil were taken, things were sliding off hills,
yep.
Any number of things. Any questions, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, I have a constituent that I think designs homes,
okay,
for example. How does this impact him?
Is he an engineer?
I don't believe he is.
Doesn't change anything at all. So house designers and contractors can still do what they're doing. All we're doing is saying, if you're an engineer and you do a house, you have to do it right, and you have to stamp it and tell us you've done it according to the standards. And then if you've done it wrong, we have the ability to go after you.
Follow up if I may. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So if he designs a house, does it still have to be approved by an engineer?
No.
Has to meet building codes.
He will turn it into the building department. The building department, this is another key.
Okay, so if they see a problem, then they're going to say, you have to engineer this truss or whatever because it's...
Very possibly, yes.
Okay.
Yes, great. Absolutely.
Right. I, as a builder, can design anything. My concept
That's right.
To meet building codes. And then if it doesn't, then I have to go find a registered, licensed engineer engineer whatever kind of load I'm putting on.
Right.
Or stress or whatever. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had a number of bills, just I guess maybe a handful of residential contractors wanting to do work in a commercial building, those sorts of things. Those come through consumer protection. I don't think they brought them here because I think they knew it would happen in here as well. But this is one of those where I think it's...
They knew they'd get a fair hearing, Representative.
Well, absolutely, Mr. Chair. And I wouldn't have any opinions anyway. But having said that, I think this bill is about public safety. And it's about the safety of the people. Impact is about safety of communities. It's about safety of our first responders. You know, Representative Cameron brings up an important point, and that is, you know, oftentimes as firefighters, we're looking at the load being distributed equally and having those roof lines engineered because we're operating underneath in fire ground where we're counting on that roof having a life of X amount of minutes, assuming it's been structurally engineered and it's sound. Houses are different from commercial, but they're all still in needs of load. They need to be registered and engineered. And so I appreciate you bringing the bill forward, and I'll be supporting this.
Representative.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that if they stamp it, then you can go after them if something happens. Well, what exactly means go after them? What can you do to someone?
We can pull their license, and we can assess civil penalties. And the way it, because the key is, when you stamp it, by our rules and regulations,
certification at that point.
It's a certification that it's safe. Mm-hmm. And that it's buildable and so on and so forth. I mean, that's the key when they stamp it. But right now they don't have to stamp these things. And I think a subtlety is when a building department sees that something's been done by an engineer, they don't look at it quite as carefully as they do typically when it's maybe a contractor or a building designer. So a lot of times the stuff goes through without the sort of scrutiny that it normally gets because it was done by an engineer. So that's another subtlety, that if these guys are incompetent, they're getting away with stuff they shouldn't be getting away with. It's a public health and safety issue, I think.
And your local building code officer is not an engineer necessarily. It could be, but
the majority of them are not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They don't get out.
They get the code.
They do all the math and figure it all out.
Yeah. Exactly. So.
So, Representative, and just on top of that, I think the assumption is by all those involved, other than that particular engineer, is that this is done according to the code and per engineer specs.
Bingo.
It's not being
that's
done.
That's the
so
subtlety and the danger, I think.
False sense of security is,
exactly. That is a huge assumption. Okay, any further questions, these good people? All righty then. Well, thank you very much. Would anyone else, do you have anything further to add? Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 143 today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the... We're ready to go on this, right? Public hearing on Senate Bill 143 and open a work session on Senate Bill 143. I would entertain a motion.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 143... is it A? Just 143 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 143 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Close the work session on Bill 143. Would anyone like to carry the bill, or should we just... What was it on the...
22-6.
Oh, we probably better have a conversation. Representative Edwards, you want to carry this bill?
Sure.
All right, very good. Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 144.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, Senate Bill 144 authorizes OSPLs to use national organization standardized examinations in evaluating applicant qualifications. The measure passed unanimously both out of the Business and Transportation Committee and the Senate floor.
And we have Ms. Lopez and Ms. Laszlo here again.
Morning.
Morning.
Good morning. I'm Amari Lopez, the Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying. Senate Bill 144 gives the authority to the board to register individuals who have taken the national standardized examinations in other states but are not licensed due to some other states require a state-specific examination in addition to the national standardized examination, and OSBILS does not, for example, for the civil engineering exam. So this bill would allow us to register those individuals from California who are required to take an additional state-specific examination.
My wife, when she got her dental degree and licensed to practice dentistry, she took, there's a Northwest whatever, and she was qualified and registered to do dentistry in Alaska and California, and that's the same thing here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these standards are pretty much the same across the board then, I'd imagine.
They're given the same day at the exact same time throughout the state.
Oh, okay. All right, any questions on these good people on this bill?
I'm kind of curious. Mr. Chair, what do we do now?
Well, we do have a statute. It's 672-148, and that's our comity statute. So it's
comity statute?
C-O-M-I-T-Y. Oh. And
we have a lot of comity statutes, too.
And that allows our board to issue licensure to applicants who have a licensure in the other jurisdiction. These individuals that would fall under Senate Bill 144 are not licensed due to not successfully passing that state examination, but they have passed the national standardization.
Chair Schaffler and Representative Esquivel, we actually currently have authority, or we believe we have authority to do this now, but this is a cleanup item. Our assistant AG recommended that we get this into statute so that it's very clear and doesn't muddle anything up in the future.
That's good. We don't want anything muddled up in this body. That's an inside statutes. Joke there.
Basically the photo, whatever.
Yeah, right. that's right, there we go.
Look at these.
Our firefighter friend has it down.
So one word I can offer you.
Mastered a word.
All right, any further questions of these nice folks? All right, seeing none. Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 144 today? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to thank you very much and say hello to your dad. It's nice to see you again. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 144 and would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 144 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 144 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Folks, it was unanimous in committee in the Senate, unanimous on the floor. Would the consent count be very good? So be it. Seeing no opposition, so moved. Anything for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, yes. I just want to remind everybody that we are not meeting on Monday. Our next hearing will be next Wednesday.
Oh, very good.
When do we sign it?
June 15th.
June 15th.
And we will be having a committee party at Magoo's on May 28th.
Thursday, May 28th.
Will they have a photogrammographer available for that?
A photogrammetric.
The ocular resonance.
Comedian. All right, we're adjourned.